Happy holidays. Today is Monday, December 30th, Los Angeles, 2019. Scott Frazier, Hayes Davenport, Alyssa Walker from, where are you, Alyssa?
A very cold place.
Same as last year.
A cold place.
It's always like this.
Colorado. You're from coming live from Colorado, where the temperature is?
Maybe four now. I didn't check. It might be four.
At the tone, it will be 4 degrees.
It's our last episode of 2019. We're going to do the same thing we did last year. We're going to talk about what we each think is the biggest or most evocative, representative story of this year in LA. We also are going to talk about things that we predicted, or not predicted, but things that we hoped would happen in 2019 last year. We're going to play clips of our young selves.
Our resolutions for the discourse.
Yeah, and also things that we hope happen next year. But let's start with some LA stories. Who has them?
Hayes, do you want to go first?
Sure, I'll go first. So I was listening to our episode from last year, and Alyssa's story was about taking the flyaway to the airport, which you did this year as well. Is that right, Alyssa?
I did. Same thing.
So I got in last night from DC. My flight was delayed. There's like horrible turbulence. And I come in on Southwest, which is Terminal 1, which is right next to LA exit. But I'm still like, I'm going to take the flyaway, the Hollywood bus. And there's a woman who has been waiting for it already. Like, I missed the 5:15, but it's expanded holiday service.
Yeah.
So it's coming at 5:15 and 5:45. And she also said, like, she checked the website and it said that the 5:15 was going to be late anyway. So the 5:15 hadn't come yet.
Okay.
So I show up at like 5:25, 5:30 or something like that. It gets to 5:45. I'm like, okay, great. Now the 5:45 is going to come. It gets to 6. Still no bus. 3 Union Station flyaway buses have come in this period. No Hollywood bus.
No Hollywood.
6:05, 6:10.
Wow.
6:15 for expanded holiday service. And then
you're supposed to get 2 an hour and you've been waiting an hour.
Yeah.
And there have been 0.
We ask a guy at the airport and he says, it comes every hour. And I say, no, it doesn't. It's supposed to come twice an hour. It says on the schedule. See this thing you're standing right next to?
It's on the pillar right there.
It's supposed to come at 5:15 and 5:45 until January 6th.
Uh-huh.
And finally, the bus comes at 6:20. The guy says, the driver says, he also says that it only comes once an hour.
Uh-huh.
He said today was the first day that they got rid of expanded service.
Wow.
For Hollywood. Meanwhile, it says on a pillar while you're waiting that it comes twice an hour. Yes.
Until the 6th.
Until January 6th. And this was December 28th.
Wow.
So this other woman, we both resolved to not pay, and then we just did pay when we finally got on. It's $8. So I started waiting for the flyaway at around 5:30, ended up at my the Hollywood stop at 7:40. The ride was pretty fast. Took forever to get out of the Horseshoe. And the Hollywood uses those small buses.
Right.
The Union Station and Van Nuys ones are huge. The Hollywood ones are small. It filled up at Terminal 5.
Oh my God.
And
those people must have been pissed.
The people at six and seven. Yeah. And I was like, not for my cold dead hands. I'd say, like, can anyone
give up their seat?
Oh, absolutely not gonna happen. And then I take another.
They asked you? They asked
no,
them?
No, I said
wow.
If they did, but they didn't even know. And then I look at the website where it says the 5:15 LAX to Hollywood is delayed 15 to 20 minutes. It should arrive at Terminal 1 by 5:35 p.m. And I realize that that announcement was from December 11th, 2019.
Wow.
So if you go to ridelaxfly.com/map, at this moment, that announcement is still up in huge font at the top of the page.
God.
I'll show you, Alyssa, over the webcam. That's what it looks like. That the December 11th flyaway at that time is going to be delayed by 15 to 20 minutes. And then I went on the active map. It supposedly says when it's going to be coming. The entire time I was waiting, it said that 2 buses were, quote, arriving. It is so unbelievably broken. And meanwhile, while I'm waiting for the flyaway bus, how many LA exit buses did I see? The shuttle to a lot that is literally a 3-minute walk away. I wish I had counted. It's probably in the 30s or 40s.
It's like a train. It like comes through like a green train.
Yes. It's a human centipede.
There's so many of them. Yes.
A human centipede of buses.
Of electric buses.
They love to just completely disregard Fly Away in a way that is...
They hate it.
I actually did see the LAX Twitter account for only the second time ever tweet about taking public transit to LAX over the holiday break, which was kind of remarkable. But then, I mean, you're like living the SpongeBob 3 hours later meme.
Yeah. The hatred is so palpable.
The thing I didn't understand, we took the flyway to leave and we didn't understand that the buses that are on the departures level aren't prioritized. So the flyaway buses, when they're dropping people off, which I assume would delay them being able to pick people up, because it's the same bus, right? So they go around the upper horseshoe and then they loop back and pick people up in the bottom.
Right, yeah.
But they're still sitting in traffic on the top one.
Extraordinary.
So why don't they put everybody through the dedicated ones on the bottom?
Yeah, extraordinary traffic. It is so incredibly bad. Yes. I did that the other day.
I'm surprised you didn't realize this because you did mention that exact thing last year.
Yeah.
And talking about how the flyaway wasn't prioritized on the departures level.
Well, I just thought the changes that would have happened through LA exit, that there would be this bus lane. Why wouldn't they use it to drop people off? It just doesn't make any sense. But nothing does in this situation. Expanded holiday service.
That's what I said. As I was getting on the bus, I was like, so this is expanded holiday service, huh? I'm so angry.
Yeah.
It was
incredibly disappointing. Looking forward to coming home. Maybe.
I have an LA story. So my you guys obviously both traveled for the holidays. Sarah, my partner, she is also traveling right now. I ended up staying in town and it was kind of nice. Like the circumstances under which I ended up remaining here were not great because one of our dogs is getting older and we have just like struggled mightily to find somebody who can take care of her. And then like trying to do it during the holiday week was very, very difficult. We ended up not being able to find anybody who was willing to put up with her stubbornness and her just like general increasingly crotchety demeanor. So yeah, Sarah went out to Arizona to see her sister. I ended up staying here. Every time I'm like left alone, but especially this week because there's like so many people are out of town anyway, I feel like I struggle to get through like the most mundane aspects of my normal routine. I was really proud of myself one day because I was like, I am going to take the bus downtown, go to my gym, which is across from where I work, and just like go for a run and like treat myself and be really just healthy for the day, for the evening. I get downtown and I get to the building and I walk in. I've mentioned before on this program, I'm not a very observant person. I walk in, I'm like, it's kind of dark in here. I walk up, I have my gym membership card taken out and the guy at the desk is like, well, as you can see, power's off for the entire building. Power's off for the whole building. We just have emergency lighting on right now. I was like, oh, I was like, do you know when it's going to come back? He's like, well, it went off for the whole block about an hour ago. So we're just waiting. We don't know when it's going to come back yet. There are parts of the facility that are open. If you want to hang out, that's okay. I was like, okay, great. So I'll just
free weights, the dumbbells,
right?
Plug in.
One of the other people recommended that I could go do a dark steam in the steam room. I was like, that sounds fine. Still in keeping with my idea of generally just relaxing. So elevators are off. And I was like, okay, I'll go up to the locker room and wait for the power to come back on. I get into the stairwell, walk upstairs. I get to the fifth floor and then at the door of the locker room, I'm turned away and they're like, we are closing. We're closing the whole building because there's no power. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was told we were waiting for the power to come back on. He was like, no, we're closing the building now. So, okay, turn around, go back downstairs. I was like, well, I guess I could just like go for a run or something. But instead, I lost all motivation and I went around the corner and instead started drinking cocktails at whatever it was, 4 p.m. Spent the night. It was actually fun because I spent like the entire like next few hours talking to a really nice bartender who was telling me all about her experience being a beard for different L.A. celebrities. I enjoyed that.
Wow.
That was fun.
This is the real LA story.
Yeah.
got stories of unrelated to bearding, but about like different abusive men in the LA media scape, including Chris Brown. And that was, it was like hopping over a wall to like get out of his place because like,
wow.
Yeah. It was very interesting, very, I don't know, eye opening, but just like, I was like, this is exactly what I wanted tonight. It did feel like I was kind of, treating myself to the kind of content that I, that I'm like extremely good at attracting myself towards. And then I took from there, I took the Metro electric bikes for the first time, which was really fun.
That's a Christmas treat.
I don't think I'll ever go back to the non-electric ones because they
I'm spoiled by them too.
Yeah.
Why was the power out?
They really are everywhere.
Because it rained so much?
Oh, wait. And the electric bike chair still worked even though the power
Yeah, it was for that. It was like literally just for that block. It was but yeah, I do think it had to do with the storm the previous day. So we got that rainstorm that came through and like dumped incredible amounts of snow on the mountains around here. Even like the mountains above Burbank, like the really small hills there had snow on them and it was beautiful. So all in all, amazing air, amazing week riding Metro bike around. It's free right now still. So yeah, it was good. It was a good time.
Alyssa?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk more about what Scott was talking about when to see from afar all these amazing photos of the snow. Mm-hmm. And it was like the trifecta of the low snow line, super clean air, right? And the light traffic, right? All three things on one day because people were out of town, people like me. And it was just so, you know, it was gorgeous. And I just have to make everybody... you know, be my downer self and just remind everybody that it used to snow more. And if we would get our act together, that we could have this, you know, it wouldn't just be this rare thing, but also the clean air and the light traffic, we could also have that. You know, it's if you like this day, if you enjoyed this day on social media for Los Angeles, let's work towards making it a more of a everyday occurrence in over the next decade, because it's possible to have this every day.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people, I think this is like a common, this is a common thing on LA Twitter where it's like, there's a holiday and everyone's like, oh, this is what it's like when like no transplants are here or whatever. And it's so great because there's no traffic, but there are like an endless number of examples of peer sized cities to LA that do not have as much traffic as LA does. New York is substantially larger as a city than LA is and has really good air quality and has, you know, like alternatives where there don't need to be 8 million cars on the road like there are here. It's definitely achievable. It just requires a little bit of effort that we haven't put in.
Did rain a lot from the 22nd to the 26th. We got about 2.75 inches.
That's remarkable.
Of rain. I think it's the rainiest December since 2010. And we've already exceeded our rain total from two seasons ago when we had like the really, really bad year. It was about like 4.5 inches. Yeah. Like we've cleared that going into what are usually the two rainiest months of the year, January and February. That's good news.
That is good
That's
news.
Good.
Yeah.
Let's quickly get into a couple of stories from this week and then we'll talk about year end review. There was an article in the LA Times that this is kind of a good summary of the whole decade of the 2010s. An article talking about a study from Rent Cafe that pulled data from a number of different places that found that the average rent in city of LA has gone up 65% since 2010, which is compared to the national increase of 36%. And that doesn't even cover the places where it has exploded most dramatically. In Westwood, the average rent is $4,944 a month. Which is about double the average of the rest of the city.
Wow.
Median household income only grew 36% in that time, which is also like doesn't account for the fact that that's a lot of, like new residents are wealthier than the ones that are leaving. That's like part of the increase. And it still doesn't even come close to matching how much rent has ballooned in that time. And this is in a city where most of our rent stock, most of our apartments are rent controlled.
Was this stat for LA City or was it for the MSA, the statistical area?
That was for the city of LA.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
How did this happen? That's what I want to like, because if you think back to 2010, like we were in the middle of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. It was unclear at that point if LA in particular and the country in general were going to recover from that financial crisis. Yeah. It did last in LA. It lingered, the effects of it, for years after 2010. So to be at a place where the average rent has increased by 2/3 less than a decade on from that, how did we get here? How did that happen?
It kind of makes sense if you think about, like, so in a rent-controlled apartment, rent is allowed to go up by 3% a year. Until this year, it was 4%. And so that's rent-controlled places. The absolute baseline is that rent goes up between like 30 and 35%. Every time it turns over, they can jack up the rent as much as they want. And that doesn't include whatever, 20, 25% of the stock that is allowed to go up indiscriminately.
Right.
I mean, I think it does kind of match what we've seen around the city. I don't know, Alyssa, are you surprised by these numbers?
I'm not surprised. We also did a story at Curbed about neighborhoods where housing prices went up, the, you know, sales prices of houses over the last decade. And it's there. The pattern is, you know, it's a different thing than rent, but you can see the same trends happening. Like, people who are wealthier are moving in, and people who are not as wealthy and are not homeowners are getting moved out. And the one thing that was, like, I think the most striking was the Westwood thing, because those are where students are living next to very, very wealthy homeowners who have fought every single proposition for more housing to be added in that neighborhood for students, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, to me, it's also one of the neighborhoods where you've seen, like, I guess the housing prices can't really go higher. They're already very, very high. But you're pushed up against all these other neighborhoods where you're seeing people move into them and buy houses, people near, like, some of the tech communities and, like, the on the west side. So you're seeing all this pressure being exerted on these neighborhoods. But I mean, how does a student exist now going to some place like UCLA? What do you do? You commute like an hour or two a day to get to somewhere that you can afford to live?
It's true. There are not really that many more. There aren't that many more cheap neighborhoods, even anywhere within, like, the striking distance of the west side where students can live. There used to be a handful of areas that did attract UCLA students in large numbers. Palms was a neighborhood that had a lot of grad students when I first moved here. And my partner Sarah was in grad school. Now Palms is even probably significantly too expensive for a new grad student coming to the area to be able to afford. It's gotten pretty bad. And on the west side, I think the crisis is particularly acute, but we are also seeing the same, I think, relative to what people can afford, we're seeing the same types of price pressures all over the city and region. I do think, though, so Hayes, you said like 35% is about the baseline for what we would have seen if this were just like rent-controlled apartments going up 3% every year. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I look at this and it does somewhat surprise me. I think a lot of the discussion that we've had as a city has been about the way that market rate housing, market rate rentals affect the cost of the cost of renting in Los Angeles. But the fact of the matter is there are not enough new housing developments that have been built to substantially affect or to substantially double what would be the baseline of this rent-controlled increase that we would have seen otherwise. There just aren't enough of them. So I think it's really like you have to look at things like Costa Hawkins, the statewide law that you mentioned at the top, Hayes, that allows for landlords to set rents at whatever they want whenever there's turnover. There is the Ellis Act, which allows for landlords in certain circumstances to evict tenants from their units, even if they would otherwise be protected from eviction, as is the case in most of LA. But really, you have to look at, so 75% of the rental stock in LA is rent controlled, is covered by the rental stabilization ordinance. And what are the factors that are causing people to move out of those units? And then that is where we're seeing these major price increases. That has to be what's happening here. I personally have, since I moved to LA in 2012, I've lived in 5 different apartments, you know? So I have an average tenancy of like a little bit over a year in each apartment that I've been in. And there are a number of different factors for that. The cheapest apartment that I ever had in East Hollywood was one where the building changed hands and then the new owners did not do any upkeep purposefully because they wanted people to move out so they could then double the rent there. And they did. They doubled the rent. That's like the kind of thing that I think that we're seeing a lot all over town. What is to be done about that, though? Because it's like that's not something that, you know, we see people unable to hang on, ending up in their cars or leaving the region altogether. This is not a sustainable pattern in LA.
I think you have to focus on new construction, for one thing, like building a different kind of housing than what's going up now. I think a big reason why rents are being dragged up the way they are is that about 90% of all the housing in the city is non-affordable.
Yep.
And changing that ratio significantly, I think, would bring the average down substantially. And there's a lot of stuff we can do with our RSO that the council hasn't even entertained. And I'm interested to see. I'm not super optimistic that the new rent gouging laws are going to make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe at the highest end of rents being increased, they might help a little bit. But that still is like 8% annually,
right?
That landlords are allowed to do. And so that would have, like, if all landlords did that, then that would have brought up the average even more than it actually went up. Let's talk about another real estate story. This is about the new Clippers Arena in Inglewood, which we've talked about throughout the year. Steve Ballmer wants to build this billion-dollar arena. It is being fast-tracked by the state, but they still had to release an environmental impact report. Alyssa, how did that report come out?
Well, I mean, this is one of those examples of you get these... So you try to get permission from the state to speed up, you know, the building of certain projects. And this is one of those things that's moving very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And talking about a place that's seeing a lot of pressures when it comes to both rent and housing prices, Inglewood is so different from what it looked like a decade ago when it comes to the number of people who can afford to live there, housing prices by new people moving in there and buying up houses and maybe forcing longtime renters out. So there's a lot of really complex issues going on there. And other sports stadiums that, you know, in other parts of the city. So you've got these big projects that are being lured in. And for some reason, the reason that only the leaders of that city will know, they want them to happen even faster to accelerate the changes that are already occurring in this very small city that is surrounded by the city of LA. So what's happening here is mostly about traffic mitigation, which is the biggest concern for this arena, which does not get close enough to a brand new rail line that is coming pretty close to it, that is opening next year, but it's not quite close enough. So you'll have to have something like, and same thing for, you know, the NFL stadium, right? That's going to be there. So it's going to be like close enough that people might take a shuttle or, you know, something like the flyaway, which we know how that will go, to get people from that rail line. But probably most people are going to drive. And so I was so shocked to read this report, which is signed off by our air board, which is, you know, great and progressive in trying to reduce the number of vehicular trips that are occurring all over the state. And for some reason are giving this stadium a pass and saying that what they're doing is going to be okay when it comes to traffic mitigation. I was super shocked to hear it. And the story that we ran was, you know, saying that this traffic plan they have, which I think it has, like, we put in some EV chargers. And, you know, it's just not anywhere near enough. Right. Like, this is our chance to make a truly, you know, forward looking arena that could serve the community. And they've done nothing. They really haven't done anything.
Yeah, I mean, the EIR that came out, which was put out by AECOM, who have been behind a number of the, like, largest stadium proposals in the LA region in recent years and decades. I think the LA Times reported it was something like a 10,000 page document or something like that. And it addressed some of the principal complaints that have been leveled against the new stadium plan for the Clippers. Those being, as you mentioned, Alyssa, traffic that will be generated, car traffic that will be generated by the stadium, gentrification in the Inglewood area, and the viability of other stadiums in the Inglewood area, which is specifically a reference to Madison Square Garden Company's The Forum, who the parent company of which is in the process of suing the city of Inglewood for fraud in allowing this development to go forward for the Clippers. So this EIR, I personally think that this whole thing, the way that it was reported by the Times, I appreciated the way that curbed handled the EIR by actually like centering sort of the reaction that it generated from people who are most closely in touch with the impacts of stadium development in Inglewood, not just the Clippers, but also the Rams on the ground. That was different than what the Times did. There was a story that I believe the byline was Nathan Fenno.
Yeah.
And I felt like they were extremely credulous about what the EIR, the environmental impact report, said was going to happen. Namely, traffic impacts would be a concern, but gentrification would not be affected at all by the stadium.
And the first quote is from the developer describing the project as the most fan-intensive basketball experience in the country.
Yeah. And then it also ends with another quote by him saying, like, sort of doing like a Rodney King, why can't we all just get along?
If we can all cooperate, if we can all get past the silliness and pettiness we've been in, then we can get back to being good neighbors like we should be.
Yeah. So that's apparently all you need to know about this. I mean, what reason do we have to not believe AECOM, who are only getting paid tens or more of millions of dollars to push this project across the finish line? I mean, the goal of putting out an environmental impact report is not to shoot your own foot off. You're trying to actually build something at the end of the day, not say, oh yeah, everybody who's suing us is making a good and valid point. So to me, that was kind of curious. And I think that the report, as covered by the Times, does accomplish several things that we know are in progress. James Butts, mayor of Inglewood and also chair of the Metro Board, has recently written a letter to the South Bay Council of Governments saying that he would like to request $250 million of Measure R money that was earmarked for highway construction and change that over to building a stadium connector from the Crenshaw line to these two new stadium developments. Obviously, I think not spending that $250 million on highway construction is good. That being said, this is kind of a blatant cash grab by the city of Inglewood, who have already had Metro fund the study of this project. Metro did study it before Butts was the chairperson and then came back and said, okay, this is very expensive. It will get very little use. And if the city of Inglewood wants it, you should pay for it. Mm-hmm. And James Butts said, no, thank you. You guys can pay for it with county money. And so that's kind of the path that is continuing to go down. Then we also have the gentrification issue, which has been, you know, if you look at Inglewood, it is one of the few remaining Black communities in Los Angeles that has not been entirely disrupted at this point by gentrification. It's still now in the process of being disrupted, but I don't see a good reason why anyone should take the view that Black communities in Los Angeles should give the benefit of the doubt that they are not going to be swept away. There's so little of Black Los Angeles left. And I think that those concerns deserve more intensive interrogation than for a company who's getting paid to say there's nothing to see here, to be able to just get away with that. And then, of course, there are the ongoing Ballmer and James Dolan battle that is, you know, substantively less interesting, I guess. But that is also something where the partners, Clippers and the city of Inglewood, would like to see those issues dismissed as well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about 2019. I listened to our episode from last year, our year-end episode, where we talked about the biggest stories of that year. Alyssa and I both said the protests in Koreatown to stop a homeless shelter from being built there. Scott, you talked about the lack of political leadership in the city overall. Pretty striking how, I mean, it's only a year later, but how similar the stuff we were talking about then is to what we, I'm sure, will be talking about today. But let's start with what each of us thinks is the most representative story of this year that happened in L.A. Alyssa, what's yours?
I just got to go with the May massacre, like, of the housing bills. Mm-hmm. I got to go for, like, the state big picture because think about a year ago right now, like, what hope we felt going into 2019, our Democratic supermajority, our new governor who promised to build all this housing and make it his top priority. And then by the midpoint of the year, it was very clear that none of this was going to have only, like, very emaciated housing bills were going to make it through the legislature, and it's kind of gotten even worse since the midpoint of the year. Like, even more disappointments have shown up on our doorsteps and lack of doorsteps. And I'm not feeling very good about next year when it comes to what our state is going to be able to accomplish. Because also at the local level, so many of the cities are, as Scott mentioned last year, failing to take step up and take leadership roles. So I'm just feeling like double bummer, I guess.
The only bright spots, I guess, would be a couple things snuck through later after the May massacre. AB 1482, the David Chu rent gouging bill that we just talked about.
Which was amended to incorporate some of the just cause eviction protections that had been in 1481.
And the ADU stuff that just snuck through, the double ADU legalization.
But like, we're already seeing pushback on the ADU stuff. You're seeing communities like Glendale and Burbank being like, oh, well, we don't have to build. We're not going to allow that to happen. We don't have to build ADUs. So this is like, it's going to be another huge fight. And we have nobody real. We have Anthony Portantino, who has stopped SB 50, right? The biggest dramatic turning point, I guess, in the state housing battle. He's running unopposed for, you know, in his district, this Foothill Cities district. So where does the change start happening? Where is the leadership going to come from? We have some great ones. We have some great people who are out there fighting these battles, but not feeling so good about it at our local level.
Scott.
Yeah, I went back and forth between a couple of different ones. There were things that I felt like were very evocative of the state of the city at present, the jeopardy that we find ourselves in going towards the future. One of the first things I thought about was LADWP's fight against the Green New Deal here, the LA Green New Deal, which we've talked about as being relatively uninspiring and insufficient, but the largest municipally owned utility in the country has been fighting tooth and nail against its implementation, and even was attempting to open new coal firing plants out of state to circumvent the impacts of that. So that was one of the things that I felt like kind of is very indicative of where we're at going into the 2020s. But I eventually decided the death of Nipsey Hussle was something that I felt like was so keenly felt across LA political classes, across social structures here, that I really can't think of anything that more represents the city in 2019, rather. So Nipsey Hussle, who was shot in the parking lot of his Marathon clothing store, where he was a fixture in the community at Slauson and Crenshaw for so many years, for the majority of his life. To go back to something I said just a few minutes ago about Inglewood, the losses that Black LA has endured during the 21st century have really been immense. And this is reflected in almost any map that you look at of LA. Black communities are shrinking and disappearing, and these communities are being disrupted. People are being cycled in and out of jail and then into homelessness and then eventually, you know, out of city, out of state, out of county. It's hard to grapple with. I think that losing Nipsey is kind of just a, as we end the 2010s, is a reminder of how tenuous the position of Black Angelenos is at this present moment. And it's something where I'm grateful for the coverage that this very tragic event got, particularly from Streets Blog LA, which with Sara Suleiman, who, of course, friend of the show and came on and spoke with us about Nipsey's death. That coverage has really been second to none. The way that Black communities in LA, Black and Brown communities in LA, came together in the wake of Nipsey's passing, it was, if not unprecedented, it was remarkable to see on such a scale. There was the processional that came through all these different neighborhoods in South LA and brought people together to celebrate just the legacy of somebody who was willing to live in the community that he cared about, who was willing to put his put his life on the line, as it turned out. But because he believed so strongly in the promise of what Black LA could and should be, and realized that there were just things that nobody else would do for us. So I think that is the story I think that resonates most deeply with me as we close out 2019. And I think that there are a lot of questions that not only Black LA, but also LA in general, and our political leaders who made so much at the time of their proximity, who made overmuch, I would say, of their proximity to Nipsey Hussle, now owe to these communities. And I hope that we start seeing that get paid back.
My story relates to a couple big issues that we were dealing with in LA last year, again this year, homelessness and fire. I think it's the firebombing of an encampment in Eagle Rock.
Yeah.
That turned out to be perpetrated by the son of the president of the Eagle Rock Chamber of Commerce.
Yep.
I think it just gets at some like a backlash from some positive trends that we were talking about at the end of last year, that the city was finally getting it together to build bridge housing, that a lot of permanent housing was going to start opening. The fact that by the end of 2019, not a single HHH unit is open yet, that we saw the Sherman Oaks shelter go down because of pushback. We've seen the Venice shelter get delayed so dramatically. Thank God they lost, the people fighting that lost all their cases, and that is going to get Bill.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of backlash this year in both directions, but from people that wanted to see more done and are not seeing it, and the people that don't want it to happen. I mean, this was the year that we had that guy in Sherman Oaks quoted in the LA Times saying that they should build, that when they built the internment camps for Japanese people, they didn't do it in the middle of the city.
Right.
We should build these like places out in the desert where people can go. This is all tied into the Trump administration talking about coming in and like cracking down on homelessness, and the fact that in our most recent count doesn't correspond to this calendar year, but the count that we got showed that homelessness had grown by 16% in the city of LA. All of this combined, and listening to our episode from last year talking about the Koreatown shelter getting moved to a new site in Westlake, and that's not even up yet.
Right.
Sometime in early 2020, they say that that one is going to be up. It is under construction. You can see it.
Right.
But we're so far behind the pace that we need to be to accomplish anything when it comes to this crisis. You read that story about rent exploding the way it has over the last decade, and we don't have anything in place to stop that from happening again. It feels like our only hope is a recession. The action that is being taken at the city, state, federal level, there's been a clear indication that they're not going to meet the urgency that this problem demands with three people dying on the street every day. And the only way out is going to be a radical devaluation of property values. Just like that's what lowers rent. That's what gets people back into housing. That's the only way we got out of the last homelessness crisis, which like we don't talk about enough. We still haven't reached the peak of like the numbers of people who are homeless in LA.
Right.
There were more in like 2006, 2007, mm-hmm. like that period. It's arguably more visible now even than it was then. But there were huge, huge numbers of people experiencing homelessness in that time. And what got us out of that crisis was just rents going down because of a recession that was driven by a real estate bubble.
Yeah.
What else is, I mean, and it's not something we can hope for, because that will cause employment crises that like could potentially make the problem even worse in the other direction. But like what else? Is, I mean, like a year later from public, when we were talking about this problem.
Public housing, right, is a main thing where it's like we've had to ride out in LA. We've had to ride out every explosive growth in housing prices without any kind of safety net or anything. We have one bright spot this year where it's like you can, starting January 1st, you can no longer discriminate based on whether or not someone's paying for their rent with Section 8 vouchers. But that money is very limited.
The money's limited, and that's still very difficult to enforce. Landlords can find all kinds of ways discriminate against tenants.
That's true.
And just claim that it has nothing to do with the fact that they're bringing a voucher. So, I mean, it's that kind of, that's what I really worry about, is there are so many reforms that are pushed forward that are celebrated as these like transformative changes that really are not going to do shit.
Yeah.
And that
makes the problem potentially more difficult to solve. When you celebrate Absolutely. Very small changes as huge triumphs, it makes it more difficult to get the big stuff done.
Yeah.
And going into 2020, it is difficult to see a way out. We are going to finally, I mean, like, look, best case scenario, we're going to see these HHH buildings start to open. Mm-hmm. And those will pull people out of homelessness, and it'll be great when that happens for those people.
Yeah.
But best case scenario, as those start to open, it's going to be a few hundred, which will not account for even close to the number of people that have become homeless in the time period since HHH was first put forward. And it's dangerous in a way to criticize HHH because this is such a politically sensitive issue and it's so easy to disparage this kind of housing and to get it killed. But I mean, I think we just have to acknowledge that what was seen to be our biggest solution that was offered at the time, and like, we'd raised so much money for it, but like, because we've done so little to stop the pipeline into homelessness, it's now just a Band-Aid. That $1 billion is absolutely necessary. We need those units, but it's it pales in comparison to the solution that we at this point we now need 3 years later. Okay, let's talk about what we want to see next year in LA. I'm going to play clips for. Let's talk about what we wanted to see this year for 2019. And I'll play clips of what each of us said we wanted for this year. Let's start with Alyssa.
I'm going to go back to the trees. I'm always Great. Talking about the trees.
Yeah.
And I wrote this story in June about what a mess the city's tree situation is in. So we need like a million trees in a year or something like that.
A million trees. That's what you said, Alyssa, was like a big... you can't hear the clip, and we didn't even actually play it. Just that we'll put it in later. but that's what you asked for, was like a really robust tree planting program that would lead to a million new trees in Los Angeles.
All right. Well, I got like a stocking stuffer of
you
a
did.
Gift, I guess. so it's a hopeful moment, I think, for trees. We had some pretty good responses from the city when it came to the pressures, I think, of a lot of journalism, which should be given credit for, I think what set the agenda at the city level, which was really exciting. There was a lot of stories, one by Sam Block about shade, and then there was one in the New York Times about shade. There was stories by people like Susie Cagle, you know, coming and talking, going out in the streets and talking to people who try to use the streets in ways that are not in vehicles, not in cars, I guess, to get around or to do business or to just exist, and seeing how deficient the streets actually are when it comes to shade. And then also on the same side of that was great advocacy work, places like Investing in Place, really talking about how we need shade and bus shelters, and, you know, trees are part of that. And then the whole climate issue, I think, is urgent, of course, but like the truly urgent part is that we get these in the ground as soon as possible and start this tree planting.
Right.
So the city is just about to start. It hired a new tree person, a city forest officer,
mm-hmm.
chief forest officer. I don't know what level. Rachel Mallerich, which is really exciting. She was from Tree People, which is one of the big advocacy nonprofits here when it comes to planting trees. And they are starting right now. They're at the point where they're doing the count, I guess, like the census of what is out there, and they're going to get the actual data. We haven't done this since the 90s. So that's exciting. But again, I mean, why aren't we just planting some goddamn trees already? We're only going to get 90,000 mm-hmm. through this initiative. And it'll be focused in low-income neighborhoods, which is great, or, you know, shade-deprived neighborhoods, which is great. But I still don't see the sense of urgency that I wanted a year ago.
Right.
To just fill every tree well and start pulling up the pavement and putting these forests on every corner or at every bus stop. You know, the city rolled out this big plan where they were going to put umbrellas at bus shelters, like we talked about, which is great, but it's not getting those trees in the ground any faster.
No.
You did get one thing specifically that you asked for last year, which was the count. You mentioned last year that they have no idea what, like, how many trees we even have, how many are dying,
and all that. And that was one specific wish that it seems like they are granting. But yeah, 90,000, that's by 2021. That's the goal. Then and also they remove a few thousand a year. So that mm-hmm. is not going to get us to a million very soon.
And how many are those? How many of those trees are just replaced? They do the census and they're like, oh, we actually have 100,000 trees that are dead. Hmm. And right. Then we don't get any new trees.
Yeah. Set low targets, fail to meet them. Start again in 5 years. Seems to be the.
But I'm so thankful for any new tree. I will welcome you. Thank you for the gift of trees.
Scott, you had a very long list of demands for this year, and they were all focused around transit. Let's listen to them.
I'd like to see Metro come out with a plan for developing congestion pricing model for Los Angeles County, and using the proceeds from that to fund, as they've said that they're interested in doing, free transit. But free transit with high quality service frequencies, things that could make it more reliable and easier to use.
Okay, you mentioned bus lanes
yep.
on the major arteries, and congestion pricing was something that you had pushed forward as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I remember correctly, I think congestion pricing was actually brought up this calendar year by the Metro Board, right? It was after you...
I think that might be true, yeah. They started... So Metro started looking into ways that they could make transit free. That was something that Metro CEO Phil Washington said, that the goal of Metro, the stated goal, was to make transit free for everything, for everyone.
That was another thing that you demanded.
Oh, Metro has a history of actually saying that they are going to do these very high and lofty things and then like never doing anything about them, even sort of mundane things like getting bus lanes put down. But yes, they did begin talking about congestion pricing as a way to actually start turning around the losses in transit ridership, to reduce traffic for people and to prepare for the 2028 Olympics, of course, is something we always come back to nowadays. So that did actually start moving this year. We haven't done it in, we've started studying it. So,
but there was a Curbed article on January 16th of this year, right after you had mentioned congestion pricing as something you wanted to see happen. And it has continued to be a discussion. I believe, the feasibility study has been signed off on.
Right.
So in terms of like what we could have hoped for congestion pricing happening this year, I would say that actually...
significantly more than I expected, honestly, yes. It did.
But the Flower Street bus lane, that would count under your...
What a success that was. That is definitely something that should be the model for how bus lanes go forward in this city. We have sort of counterbalancing examples to draw from, because there is also the Eagle Rock bus-only lanes, which... were famously opposed by, again, the mother of the Eagle Rock fire bomber and a host of NIMBYs out there. But then on Flower Street downtown, we saw what should be the model for putting bus lanes everywhere in the city. It was a process that was quick. It was extraordinarily successful. It was publicly popular, and it has been extended beyond its original scope. And we will hope in 2020 that it will continue to be allowed to exist and made permanent by the Metro Board. But that does give me some hope, because what we saw in Flower is what we need to see ultimately everywhere. That is a far more, frankly, a far more important project than the Eagle Rock, the Colorado Boulevard bus-only lanes. But we need to see these popping up everywhere.
And you didn't get bus lanes on Sunset or Hollywood, but the campaign to make that happen did get started this year. Sunset for All was born to move that exact thing forward. So not bad.
Not bad. I didn't realize I took so many swings at it. I also want to bring up another thing I asked for in this episode, I think earlier, was that we should leave behind the notion that
homeless people are not actually valid members of the communities in which they live. That,
yeah,
frankly, did not happen.
It didn't happen.
We saw instead that rhetoric now being espoused by Governor Gavin Newsom, among others. You know, this is something that now it seems like has made it
mainstream.
Toxic rhetoric has made it to the highest levels of the Democratic establishment, which is really upsetting. These are people who are vulnerable. They are people who are part of their community, whose problems are the problems of the community and should be treated as such. So Steve Lopez, Gavin Newsom, you know, boo on you.
Let's talk about what I wished for 2019, sort of related to that.
Going back to homelessness stuff, I don't think there really exists something that should exist in the city that doesn't. Is an actual grassroots organization of residents who go around to public meetings about bridge housing, permanent supportive housing in their neighborhoods, even in other neighborhoods, go to city council meetings and are as loud a voice in favor of getting new housing like for people who are homeless put into their neighborhoods as there are as loud as the voices against it.
So I wish for a citywide movement that I suggested be youth-led to campaign, be as loud a voice in favor of increased homeless services and housing against the people that have historically fought those things. You would think that this would have not been a great year for that kind of thing, but I actually feel like we saw a lot more of that than I was necessarily expecting, too. There was a Services Not Sweeps campaign.
Yep.
Which only launched on April 3rd and did exactly that. Went to these meetings and screamed at people to stop criminalizing poverty and to like provide more services for people who live on the street and to advocate for new housing. And they got a significant number of their demands, if not fully met at this point, at least the city has acknowledged them and claimed to start implementing them. We still have a long way to go. There were sweeps and cleanups on Christmas Day all over the city. People had to, like, the sweeps that began at 6 a.m., which means that people had to start cleaning out their stuff at 3 a.m. On Christmas Day. But in general, that movement is growing. There are groups like K-Town for All, it feels like, really came into their own this year. They came out of the Koreatown shelter protest. They were resistance movement to that is still doing a lot of great advocacy work. Streetwatch LA, which came out of DSA, LA Can is doing what they've been doing for decades. CeeLo, the group that I work with, all these groups have kind of teamed up and exerted a significant amount of political power to the point that, I mean, who would have ever guessed that 4118, a law that was designed to allow the city to illegalize sleeping on the street, would not come really even close to getting out of city council because of the overwhelming negative response from these kinds of groups.
We have a nexus of activist energy in LA that I think Angelinos should be very proud of right now. K-Town for All, No Olympics, Street Watch. These are all groups, Ground Game, that are doing an incredible job in the face of it's not just apathy. It's a lot of it is just plain like just not knowing about things that are going on among the like day-to-day experience of Angelenos. A lot of the time there's little exposure to issues that are facing unhoused people or things that are directly coming out of City Hall. And I think that we have a really solid group of activists who are working hard to change that. And I think we are starting to see that change. It is a coalition that spans a lot of different policy interest areas, but is definitely growing, is definitely becoming more powerful, is definitely starting to shape discussions that happen in City Hall.
And I want to say this movement is not brand new. Like LA Can in particular has been doing it for a long time, but it has grown significantly and they're voice has kind of been added to in a big way this year.
And I think yielding political candidates now. So we have people who are making this a central part of what they're running on at both our city council and other smaller city councils around the region. So it's a big It's a big step because this could be the year that a lot of these people actually take office.
That would definitely be one of my wishes for 2020. But let's get into that now. What did we, I mean, we, our predictions last year and our wishes and resolutions were very powerful. We each got a decent amount of what we asked for. So acknowledging that that power that we have, what is it that each of us would like to see most in 2020 in Los Angeles? Alyssa, would you like to start?
I think the status quo is clearly not working when it comes to both our elected officials. I'm just going to go with the city right now. I'm going to focus on two things, the city and the Metro Board.
Uh-huh.
And there are other boards that we've discussed on this show that are also problematic. I'm not discounting a lot of people doing great jobs at both of those governing bodies, if you can call them that. But I think what I really want to see is these issues, especially around transportation and how we decide to make those decisions over the next year for climate, for equity, for just helping people bring down the cost of their everyday lifestyle so they can afford to move to expensive Westwood or, you know, buy a house in a place 2 hours away and not have to drive so far. We need some really significant changes to be made with people who are walking the walk, as I want to say. So I want our political leaders, some of them are going to change this year. Some of them are not going to be there at the end of 2020. So my wish is for both the people who are in there now to think long and hard about how they're choosing to use their influence when it comes to riding the bus, experiencing what it's like to have a 2-hour commute, experiencing what it's like to get your kids picked up from daycare in time, and to make sure that the decisions that they are making on our streets reflect the changes that they want to see because they have lived them and experienced them. And so hopefully this means that the people who don't do that are not there by the end of the year.
Scott?
So I think I will continue my tradition of making demands as opposed to wishing. What we need to see in 2020 is at the state level, at the county level, and at the city level, we need our politicians to stop accommodating the Trump regime, particularly as it relates to undocumented Angelenos and unhoused Angelenos. That has been a theme throughout this year. I don't know if anything that we have discussed on here in 2019 has made me more viscerally upset than the quote that you had, Hayes, from Eric Garcetti saying that he welcomed anybody regardless of their history to this fight in reference to Trump's new homelessness administrator who is being put on this job, particularly to cause harm to people who are unhoused.
He said that about Trump as well. That's not the only time that he said that exact thing. It's a soundbite at this point.
It's unacceptable, honestly. It's not something that it goes beyond the general fecklessness with which Garcetti has approached his job. It goes beyond being a poor representation of the city that he purports to lead. It is dangerous. It is sending a message to this federal government that they can come in here and do whatever they want to our friends and family and neighbors. And it is something that in 2020, Garcetti is not the only person who's guilty of this. Mark Ridley Thomas posted an article we talked about that was written by Ben Shapiro about the failures of liberal governments in dealing with homelessness. We are in a very precarious situation here for all of the good that groups are doing here. And for all of the good that politicians say they want to see done, they have in 2019 gone a very bad direction, and they have indicated their openness to working with arch conservative voices who would be frankly just fine with taking away civil rights from undocumented individuals, taking away civil rights from unhoused individuals, and locking them all away in somewhere that they will lose all freedom. And it is now, I think, the fight of everybody in Los Angeles who considers themselves to be a compassionate person, you know, let alone progressive or any of the rest of it, to come to their defense. And we really need for anybody who is thinking that the Trump administration can be worked with on this issue to to be out of politics, frankly.
Two wishes for the current representatives to be not have jobs anymore at the end of 2020. I echo that desire, but so this is a wish that's also sort of a resolution. This year and every year preceding it, I feel like we don't quite have the local media presence that we need to account for how low engagement still is. I think it is getting better. I think homelessness and the crisis that it has become has caused a lot more people to get involved and pay attention to what's happening. I love the LA Times. I love LAist. Everyone who works at those outlets, like there are so many great local reporters. I think Curbed is possibly doing the best work of any outlet in the city, although with like a slightly more narrow focus. I don't think any outlet has the LA Times especially has done quite a good enough job of reaching out to like help people understand the city. There's like great reporting on it, but I don't think it is necessarily doing a good job of introducing people to political characters in this city or just like helping them understand it better rather than just reporting what's going on. I think it's like a wonderful resource for people like us who already sort of know the different players involved and can provide like commentary on the story, but it's not great for people that just live here. And I think there's still the issue of the paper not necessarily prioritizing local
LA coverage,
content as opposed to stuff from around the West and the rest of the country. So this year, I think, is going to be the one where we try to do more of that. I can just tip that we are going to be expanding the stuff that we're doing this year. We're going to have a few announcements coming up. Will we replace the LA Times? I don't think that'll happen in 2020. But I would
He's just bought a printing press. It's amazing.
I would like us to do a little bit more of expanding the work that we do and giving people more ways to plug in. This is one thing that like I've kind of discovered this year that I think is really encouraging with Sila and helping out with Nithya Raman's city council campaign. If you reach out to people and you give them places to plug in to the city, the response is overwhelmingly positive.
Yep.
Like, I cannot believe how much Sila has grown in a really short time, how much people have engaged with this show. There is a desire for people to understand more about the city and do more stuff about the problems that we're facing here, but the places to plug in are not quite there yet. And I think media goes a long way towards making that easier for people, and I think we're going to try and help make that happen this year.
And we're going into an election year. You know, like you have an opportunity to affect the way that the city looks every year, but particularly in 2020, we are going to have two very good opportunities to make this a city that we are proud of. We're closing a very dark decade, I would say, in the city's history. That is not all down to Donald Trump. It has not been a good decade for LA, and let's make the 2020s better.
I think I've talked about this on the show, but I'm so optimistic about that for no reason that's like not really deserved.
Yeah.
But
Me too.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from, but you can see everything like falling into place for these big movements developing, and I hope it happens. Even if it doesn't happen nationally, I think LA could be a place where it does. Once again, I'm so grateful for the two of you doing this podcast for another year. We're coming up on 100 episodes, which we have to plan something fun for. Alyssa, have a safe trip back.
I'll be waiting at the flyway until February.
And thank you, as always, for listening. We'll be back next year on LA Podcast. Bye.